up to 5 foot, 1 inch of every lot line and is 3 stories tall, people can at least look and say, well, at least it's contributing to the community beyond the same property tax rate that I'm paying, because they have a hell of a lot more capacity to pay property taxes. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Jane.
Morning. To be very honest with you, I'm not really sure what I'm testifying on here. It's been amended. It's a little bit of a moving object. But I'm going to ask, adhering...
Oh, we do this all the time, so...
But adhering slightly to my original testimony that I prepared but will not be submitting in writing to you because I've amended it so many times, I'm asking you not to adopt the ordinance before you, that it is fatally flawed and it will result in negative consequences. For the record, I'm Jane Leo, Government Affairs Director for the Portland Metropolitan Association of Realtors. Every day our members work with the residents of the city to help them achieve their goal of home ownership. Through our Realtor Home Foundation, we provide grants to our community partners such as Hacienda CDC, Habitat for Humanity, NEA, so they can build housing for their clients who want to be homeowners. Under the proposed ordinance, the city would be moving the goal of home ownership further out of reach for the city's residents of all incomes. The ordinance under consideration is in conflict with the city's own policies and negatively impacts those nonprofit builders I mentioned, but also those who are building under the city's what is now called the Home Buyer Opportunity Limited Tax Exemption Program. They would be liable for this tax, and I ask that they be exempted. I'm asking that you retain the density exemption specifically, and Mayor, I'm a little bit confused by a comment you made, but I'm asking that the density exemption be retained, especially in areas such as what we see on the east side of Portland, where the underlying property is two or more tax lots. So allowing the builder to build on those two or three tax lots, and allowing them to be exempt for the one going down and more housing going up. Repeatedly I've heard city staff sit at MPAC and MTAC meetings at Metro and say that the city can meet its density requirements and the development should be at minimum 20 units per acre without allowing density and giving bonuses or some sort of incentive for those densities. You're detrimental to the own comments made before Metro's committees. Also, I am in support of the homeowner exemption, and I look forward to working with you on that. There has to be a way in which a homeowner has an opportunity to rebuild their house and create a dream house, whatever that dream house may look like. In closing, I would ask you not to adopt the proposed demolition ordinance. It's an attempt at a universal solution where one size doesn't fit all. And in my last few seconds, I want to say that to Commissioner Fritz's comment or her question of one of the previous speakers, what's the response when they say that the builder is gaining profit? I would ask that the city take a comprehensive and holistic look at all the fees it places on a building permit as to what it can do in that regard to reduce the price of housing across our full spectrum. Thank you.
Actually, that wasn't what I meant, whether I may have come across that way. My question is, aren't developers and sellers already maximizing the amount of that they can possibly sell the house for?
You know, the market will always place a limit on it. But for the developers, whom I do not represent, that was your previous speaker, but every business owner has to still go home and feed his or her kids. So they need to operate on some level of profit margin.
Right, and I'm not disputing that. I'm trying to elicit a comment on whether or not this $25,000 will be passed on to the buyer or not, and whether we have maxed out on housing prices here in Portland, or whether there's still some room to put them up still further.
To that point, if I may, yes, the cost will get passed on to the buyer in one form or another. Eco Northwest and DHM recently did a presentation, actually over the summer months. Many of your city bureau staff were there, including your own staff, Mr. Mayor. And one thing we heard was this city has become and continues to become a city of the very wealthy and the very poor. The person in the middle is not able to afford to be here. And you heard one of the previous speakers make a comment on that. So yes, costs get passed on, and that's where it raises a concern that that first-time home buyer is not going to be able to afford that additional $25,000.
Thank you very much. Thank you both. Okay, so let's call our staff back up, please. Jillian and Thomas and anyone else that we need. Yes, Tom, come on up. And address questions, and then we can walk through these amendments and take action on them. I think there was some work done on one of them. Yes, there was.
Mayor, is it still your intent to get through the whole agenda today before?
Yeah, I think so. There's not that much left after this. I think we can probably address these agenda, these amendments in 15 minutes. And
can
then
I, power can I start with some questions?
Sure, please.
Jillian, I've offered an amendment that deals with the situation of city acquiring a property in a flood zone with the intention of demolishing the house. And Mr. Dowd,
right,
in his very thoughtful handout, raises the question of houses in flood zones where it's not practicable to remodel the house to address code issues and other needs, where there is a, where someone may be required to essentially take it down to the foundation, fortify the foundation, and rebuild. I don't quite know how to address that today, but is that something that we could, it seems to me to be a discrete universe of homes in areas where we know there's flooding, and certainly if he lives at Willamette Park, we know with even with the new pump station we're building there, there's still going to be flooding. Is this a discrete area that we could take a closer look at and think about some changes down the road?
Yes.
And I'm loath to legislate on the fly here, and we do have an effective date here, but I would ask that on that one, my bureau and your bureaus sit down and talk about that case. It seems compelling,
mm-hmm,
particularly where it's an instance of a property owner that's going to remain in the home but has to do that to address flooding issues. And there are some areas of the city where that, I think, is acute. So I just want to flag that as an issue of concern. Is it your intent to come back to council in 1 year with a full report on the impact of this legislation and the data? Is that going to be proposed as an amendment or just as that?
Yeah, my recommendation is that we come back in 1 year or less, and the point at which we would come back in less than 1 year is when we bring forward the at least the first package of zoning code amendments that will come out of the residential infill project, because I think the council ought to look at, one, how the demolition tax is working, and two, how we're trying to shape infill development through plans and policies in addition to tax code. Well, and it would be good to do those together.
Yeah, and if this does pass, I would very much like to see a report and a presentation to council within the 1 year. Mayor, does that need to be done informally or formally?
I don't think you need to do that formally. I'll make that commitment to make sure that that comes back to council.
Thank you.
Other questions? Issues?
Yeah. Maybe we could start with having Tom address Commissioner Novick's desire for the view of the Planning Bureau.
Yes, good. Please, Tom.
Okay. Tom Armstrong, Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. I think what you face is a balancing of two values. The density exemption within the single family zones and the added lots that we get from that are actually a small part of our future growth that we're planning on. It's probably less than 10% of the 120,000 new units in the next 20 years, and you offset that with the Affordable Housing Fund revenue that you're generating. And so in terms of how we meet our future growth projections, I think the Affordable Housing Fund can go a long way towards helping us meet and create that affordable housing that offsets anything that we would lose because of the deterrent of a few infill lot splits.
This might be a question better addressed to your co-Armstrong, but I'm curious about the carbon emission impact. Obviously, there's carbon used in destroying a building and building a new one, but there's also, if you're destroying a leaky old building and replacing it with two tight ones that are near transit where people are likely to not drive, then I would think that there is a significant carbon benefit. So I'm just curious if the Bureau has done an analysis of whether, on balance, eliminating the density exemption will be a carbon plus or a carbon minus.
I'm not aware of that, especially, again, in the single-family zones. I know more so in the commercial mixed-use and multifamily zones, you do get that much bigger bump in terms of carbon savings there, but we could bring something back on the trade-offs in the single-family zones.
Mayor, I have to say, this is, I think, a pretty important issue because we are concerned about the demolition of the planet as well as the demolition of houses. And a major argument for our density policies is increased density results in fewer carbon emissions because when people live closer together, then it makes transit more viable. It makes it more likely that a grocery store will spring up within walking distance, et cetera. So I think that we really need to have some analysis of the carbon impact of this proposal.
I think that can be managed. There's a larger context of how much density we're going to provide for in the comp plan citywide, and that's where the big impact is. But nevertheless, it's worth having that research done. Okay, other requests or questions for staff? And then you've got a revised amendment here for us. Can you walk us through that, please, Thomas?
Can you hear me?
There you go.
There we go. Thank you. So the proposed amendment, I think, gets to the heart of Commissioner Saltzman and Commissioner Fish's desire to not make the low-income housing rebate a rebate structure, but rather something closer to an exemption. So the proposal would be to entirely strike 6.08.055, renaming it demolition tax exemption instead of demolition tax rebate. And then I can read through this language if we need to do that for the record. I believe you have a written copy in front of you.
Go ahead and read it into the record, Thomas. Okay.
Following the issuance of a demolition permit, the owner may apply for and obtain a temporary abeyance of the demolition tax assessment on the basis of subsequent development of affordable housing at the property. The Portland Housing Bureau shall adopt administrative rules for qualifying. In this first instance of the word exempt, I would strike from this amendment.
Okay.
So it would read, the Portland Housing Bureau shall adopt administrative rules for qualifying affordable housing as exempt from demolition tax using criteria under either Section 30.01.095 or the Home Buyer Opportunity Limited Tax Exemption Program, because I understand there were two proposals here.
So that's a choice we have to make.
Choice the council needs to make, correct.
Okay. Right.
And then continuing, if the subsequent housing development qualifies as affordable housing under the Portland Housing Bureau's administrative rules, the director, that would be the revenue director, shall determine that the demolition tax, that no demolition tax is due.
So this is, in effect, a rewritten version of Commissioner Saltzman's.
It's exactly. It gets to the intent and just a lot more comfort in terms of administrability.
And my mayor, too, is that right? So it's
and then there's another
those.
Final piece of this. Is that if subsequent housing development does not qualify as affordable housing, the director shall determine that the demolition tax assessment is due and payable.
Thomas, the virtue of Commissioner Saltzman's amendment was it's very straightforward and clear. The virtue of this is apparently has your blessing, but it is a little harder to read. Just for the record, why would you prefer this somewhat more convoluted approach, and what's the benefit?
Well, the language is more convoluted. The approach actually isn't more convoluted. However, the language we had before really tried to offer an exemption for an action that's taken after the assessment. That's just not the appropriate way to structure that. That really would have been more of a rebate. So that's why we got the term abeyance in here. We think it's an abate assessment. The assessment's still there, but we're going to obey it until such time as the Housing Bureau has validated that the activity that we wanted to see occurred, and at that point then.
Right, and does that, the nice thing about an exemption is it takes that cost off the pro forma. Does an abeyance, what's the timeline between the abeyance and the ruling?
The timeline really would be geared on how quickly the developer could complete the demolition and the subsequent building of the new housing.
Okay.
So the timeline isn't set, and you know we were silent as to timeline here because I didn't want to get into a situation where developers rushing to complete a build or otherwise trying to meet an arbitrary timeline for us, the city.
So the concern, I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. Obviously, if the council wants to provide this exemption, and I hope they do, then it has to be, the timing of the granting of the exemption has to be aligned with an event that triggers the exemption. And so your language is designed to better align those two?
That's correct.
So walk us through the choice of using 30.01095 or the Holte standard for what constitutes affordable.
I'll speak on behalf of the Holte, the Home Ownership Limited Tax Exemption. Perhaps Julian can speak to the other one. To me, the Holte is very straightforward. The council sets the home sales price cap every year, and we'll be doing that, I think, next month again for this coming year. And it's a well-established program known by the development community, known by the nonprofit community, and I just think it's a known commodity with a pretty clear determination of what the price cap is, in this case, above or below which a rebate or an exemption for the demolition tax would apply.
I mean, the only thing I would add is we started out floating with the Housing Bureau, the idea of SDC waiver. I think they just didn't think beyond that. And since, you know, this has come to Commissioner Saltzman's office, they've looked at this broader range of programs and landed on the Holte, and I think that's perfectly fine.
Okay. So I think I'd prefer that approach, too.
My preference is it be as broadly construed as possible. And so I just would hate to pick one today and find out that it was unduly limiting.
Oh, I thought you were intending for us to pick one. You'd say
Well, we are.
Yeah,
we are. You know, yeah. Direction to the Bureau would be.
So which one is more permissive? I'm sorry. I'm not sure if I'm following that.
We don't have a copy of 30.01095 because it's not part of this proposal.
The most permissive approach you could take would be to entirely strike everything after using criteria in that sentence, Commissioner.
Yeah, because they're going to do administrative rules, which we'll get to review.
Oh.
So then the modified language would be, the Portland Housing Bureau shall adopt administrative rules for qualifying affordable housing as exempt from the demolition excise tax, period. If you're comfortable, I like that.
You can go that way, but then you're asking us to create a whole new set of rules where we already have.
Yeah, but you're the commissioner in charge of housing. You can create the administrative rules however you want
to. I urge you to choose from each shelf.
I think we're giving you a lot of power here, Dan.
Most liberal construction.
I'm just trying to keep it as simple as possible.
Get as simple as possible.
Tie it into an existing program.
You get to choose as simple as possible.
You get to choose. That way we're giving you the option.
Okay.
To pick the broadest possible.
You're being railroaded into getting more power here.
Okay.
This less complicated proposal balances out my earlier comment.
So let's strike. Right. Let's take that and delete.
Commissioner, before you go much further on this, there is a question of legislative delegation in terms of what are the criteria that will help to guide the Housing Bureau in establishing this exemption.
I think, Council, we've got that.
But we have that as the legislative intent. That doesn't belong in the code.
We've made it clear we want him to be as expansive.
There is a requirement by the courts under the concept of legislative delegation to give guidance to the Bureau.
We're giving him the broadest possible grant of authority, and he's going to come back with proposed code.
Administrative rules. Which would occur outside of coming back to council.
So how about then instead of striking that, we said using criteria under 30.01095 and or home buyer limited tax exemption. Would that satisfy your concern?
How about using criteria such as 30.010
there we
or
go.
Fine.
Okay. I like that. Fine.
What we're trying to do here, Thomas. It, again, lacks the clarity of Dan's, but if it's the same intent, and we're giving him the broad authority to craft the rules with you to create the largest possible exemption for affordable home ownership, then I support this.
That's exactly what it would do. And, in fact, the commissioner and the Housing Bureau would entirely promulgate that administrative rule. We would make it available on our website, but that would be entirely up to housing.
Okay. So
make that a substitute,
So is that
Withdraw Saltzman 1 and offer this?
I'd be happy to. This
okay. Is the right time. Commissioner Saltzman withdraws his original amendment and offers this as a substitute. Is there a second?
Second. Okay. But I think we need to read into the record numbers 1 and 2 because I don't know that Thomas did that already.
Right. So numbers 1 and 2 below B that we just modified says if the subsequent housing development qualifies as affordable housing under Portland Housing Bureau administrative rules, the director shall determine that no demolition tax is due. And 2, if the subsequent housing development does not qualify as affordable housing, the director shall determine that the demolition tax assessment is due and payable. So it gives that clarity about what happens after the determination. Okay. So more questions before we try to walk through amendments? So then let's do that.
Vote on that one.
We could. You want to take that? Go ahead. We have that one on the floor. You want to go ahead and take a roll call vote on this amendment, the Saltzman amendment as modified by the handout we've received from Thomas and further modified by changing either to such as under B.
So this is the Saltzman substitute one as amended.
As amended. Correct. Further discussion? Roll call, please, on that amendment.
Novit.
I think this is a good amendment. I'm also going to ask for a vote on my tiered version, but I don't think these are inconsistent. Aye.
Fritz?
So in all my votes on the amendments, I want to be clear that what I'm trying to do here is making the underlying ordinance as good as it can be for multiple purposes. I'm not likely to support the underlying ordinance. However, I think that the amendments as proposed are going to improve it. Aye.
Commissioner Saltzman, I very much appreciate the amendment you brought forward, and I appreciate this discussion and the testimony and the commitment we're making to exempt affordable home ownership developed by our nonprofit partners, consistent with our existing rules. Aye.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Hale.
Aye. Okay, that one's done. Let's go back then, if we might, to my first amendment, which is the one that removes the rebate for multiple unit development in single family zones. Further discussion on that one? Okay, let's take a vote on that, please.
Novick?
I'm sorry, I was.
This is my number one.
With the density one?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't think that we should act on this until we have an analysis of what the implications are for our carbon use. And a couple of weeks ago, we passed a resolution opposing new fossil fuel facilities that I think was primarily because we're concerned about carbon emissions. And I think that if we're taking an action that can relate to carbon emissions, we should have an analysis of that before we take that action. So absent any analysis presented to us of what the carbon impact is of eliminating this exemption, no.
I think this makes the ordinance more defensible. Aye.
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hale?
Aye. Okay, then let's go to my second one, which was an effective date of March 1. I guess we might push you a bit, Thomas. I think there's concern both on the council and the community that sooner is better. Thoughts about that before we vote on this?
I would agree. I mean, having witnesses, as everybody knows, the 30-day delay in the renter protection ordinance resulting in sort of a rush to rent increases, that March 1st seems too far away.
So we're making a very uncomfortable situation for one of our administrators, but
well,
that's our job.
Let me we're already pushed back a little bit
plans?
From my initial thought as far as when we could bring this up.
We've just February 1 in here, and you can come back to us if you need a hardship.
I was going to suggest mid-February. And so here are the things that need to occur. We need to modify databases, get the accounting structure set up. We need to promulgate these administrative rules, which requires 30 days public notification. There's a process involved there. I've got to try to hire a staff person at Christmas time. There's a laundry list of things, and so if we make the effective date too early, there's a very good chance I'm going to fail. I would say mid-February, if that would work for the council.
You know, colleagues, anytime it's 30 days or more, there's going to be people gaming the system. I would encourage us to allow the revenue bureaus to set up the process with adequate time. Yeah.
You're right. There's going to be, no matter when unless it's tomorrow morning,
Thomas, if we told you didn't have to work on any of the sharing economy stuff, would that free up some time?
That might.
I move the amendment.
Okay, let's take a roll call on the amendment as March 1.
Novit.
Aye.
Rich.
Aye.
Fish.
Aye.
Osman.
Aye.
Hale.
Aye. Okay, then let's move next to
Fish 1,
which is the floodplain issue.
And Jillian, just to be clear, we're going to take a look at the related issue that's been flagged and see whether that comes back to council for that discrete category of homeowners.
Yes.
Okay, further discussion? Then roll call on that amendment, please.
Novick?
Aye.
Rich?
Aye.
I really appreciate the professionals at BES that brought this to my attention and made the case for this amendment. Aye.
Osman?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Now let's move to Fritz 1, which is
I actually have an amended. I said I was not only here to have one amendment, but I actually have an amendment to my amendment. And this is in response to the testimony that we heard.
Okay.
It's just clarifying. So the amended amendment is to 608050 exemptions add demolition permits where the applicant is the homeowner whose legal residential address was the site as of March 1st, 2016. That's so that there's not a lot of speculators of property owners buying things up who aren't actually living at the address.
Okay. Second.
Like that better. Further discussion? Roll call on the amended Fritz Amendment.
Novit.
Aye.
Rick?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, now let's move to Commissioner Novick's amendments. There are two.
Oh,
they are. Okay.
Amendment 1 establishes the tiered rebate structure.
Okay. Further discussion of that or questions for staff? Okay, then let's take a roll call, please, on Novick Amendment number 1.
So, I think that it is important to acknowledge that there's a difference in the affordability impact of when a house is being knocked down or replaced with a $350,000 house than when it's being knocked down or replaced with a $1 million house. And the evidence is that the average cost of a replacement house when there's been a demolition is about $500,000. I don't mind having the $25,000 tax applied to house that's sold for over $500,000. I do mind it being applied to a house that's being sold for $375,000. So I hope the council will support this amendment. Oh, aye. Sorry.
Fritz.
This really gets at the crux of is this proposal for reducing demolitions, or is it for providing money for affordable housing? What's the primary purpose of it? I think the most persuasive purpose is that it's for providing money for affordable housing. $375,000 is not affordable to a lot of Portlanders. For the median family income, $375,000 is not affordable. So the thought of giving a 50% rebate to properties that sell for 150% of median income or median sales price just doesn't meet my definition of what's affordable housing. And so I would like to have something like this. I absolutely support taxing expensive homes more than modest homes and affordable homes. I don't think this quite gets to it. No.
Fish.
Well, I'm torn on this because the arguments we've heard about affordability and housing that is truly affordable resonate with me. I'm not sure this is workable. On the other hand, currently with the interest rates, if you have the credit, you can get about $400,000 of financing if you have the credit, which translates to about a $2,000 a month mortgage. But we are in uncharted territory in terms of debt servicing. And I am worried about the police officer and the nurse that want to live in our community. And I don't think Steve would say this has been fully baked, but I think it's a good faith effort at getting at the issue. And so I'm going to support it, even though it may need some tweaking. Aye.
Osman.
Well, Well, I support the intent of this, and I think given the discussion we had earlier on determining what we're now calling an exemption, right? Exemption for affordability.
Right.
I think that the process that Commissioner Novick has outlined should serve as guidance to the Housing Bureau in developing the rules, but that I'm just a little leery of putting it into the code at this point, so I'll vote no.
I'm going to vote no for now, but and a couple reasons for that. One, this is a new thing. As we've heard, only two other small cities in Illinois have any such thing at all, and we're trying something here that we hope will work. And, Steve, what I want to see first, frankly, is the drop in demolitions and then make sure that we tune it with respect to our revenue goal, because I guess I would probably put the priorities for this in a different order than you did, Amanda. I think they're both legitimate goals, but my most urgent goal is to reduce the rate of demolition. The revenue effect is beneficial, but the rate reduction is the highest priority. So I want to see that first. I do not expect that this is something that the City Council is going to set and forget. I think we're going to be returning to this tax periodically to see how it's working, and we're also going to be returning to it to see how it fits with what the residential infill project comes up with and what we want to see actually happen on the ground. So I've always been interested in having this tax be more progressive than it will be coming out of the gate at $25,000 per demolition. So I'm very interested in considering this later, but I'd like to start at the simplest possible form of this for the moment. No.
Mayor,
let's take your next amendment.
Before we talk about that, can I ask you a question? How many demolitions do you expect the $25,000 tax to prevent?
Well, I'm hoping that it will prevent as many as 100, given that we're seeing several hundred a year. Again, we it's very difficult to forecast how many demolitions this will prevent, because as we've heard in the testimony, there's so many different market effects going on in all these different transactions. And some of them will be not dissuaded by this at all. Someone will still tear down a perfectly good $500,000 house and build a $1.1 million house down the street from Commissioner Fish if what I've been hearing about Alameda and Irvington continues to happen. In my neighborhood, the same thing. Maybe in neighborhoods where houses have not been bid up quite that much, the $25,000 amount will have more of an actual effect on the transaction. We'll see. So I'm hoping that we'll see, a 25% to 50% reduction in the rate of demolitions. But $25,000 may not be enough to accomplish that. And again, it's not as progressive as I'd like it to be. So I would hope to return to that progressivity issue not very long from now. Okay, so your second amendment.
It's still to say that the Revenue Division shall study and report to Council by June 2016 about options for administering and enforcing an exemption or rebate to the tax for existing owners who plan to occupy the house for at least 3 to 5 additional years. By existing owners, what I mean here actually is not just people who own now, but who are existing owners, pre-existing owners at the time of the demolition. What Evanston, Illinois does is you have to have lived in your house for 3 years before the demolition, then you have to live another 3 years before claiming the rebate. So it's something like that that I'd like the Revenue Bureau to consider.
So I love the spirit of this, and I know Thomas would welcome additional staff. And is there a question about whether we can or should do this outside the budget process?
Oh no, it's just that he's just setting a date, right?
Additional staff added for this activity. It's just something that we put together for the commissioner for the full council.
Yeah,
we're looking at the same.
Yeah, this is just the requirement that they come back by June 2016 with options for rebate for existing owners.
I'm sorry.
So
and just to be clear, did Katie's modified language that would say rebate or exemption be considered? Did that?
Yes, that? Exemption Good. Or rebate.
Good. Yes, it's that's in here.
Thank you.
Okay. Further questions or discussion about this amendment? Then roll call on this amendment, please.
Novick.
Aye.
I agree with Commissioner Novick. This is not mutually exclusive to the previous one, and I very much appreciate the intent. Aye.
Fish. Aye. Salzman.
Aye.
Hale.
Aye. Thank you. That's an improvement to the ordinance as well. Okay, do we have any others that I have neglected here? Okay, so comments, concerns from staff. This will come back for second reading.
I just wanted to really briefly address Mayor Hale's the issue of how a structure with more than one residential unit be treated. So that would be kind of the rare case where there's either non-conforming development, you know, something was built maybe during the war that has multiple units and is now in a single-family zone, or it could be the still relatively rare case of a duplex, which is allowed on a corner lot in an R5 zone that is actually being torn down. We think the ordinance could be a little clearer, depending on where the council wants to go with that. The exhibit reads that the $25,000 would be assessed when a residential permit is issued. And so a duplex would be demolished under a residential permit. We have a conflict with adding a definition for residential structure, which originally came in when we were trying to work with the density bonus. So that could be probably cleaned up a lot. Now, if the council wants to, you know, respond to the testimony we heard that it ought to be assessing a tax for every residential unit, that would capture, you know, duplexes, non-conforming multifamily development, single-family homes where there's a interior accessory dwelling unit. You know, we would write it that way. But as staff really understands it now, a duplex would only require one permit and only one $25,000 tax would be applied.
Okay. Anybody comfortable with that, or do you want to make another amendment?
Or a clarification. I think if the goal is to reduce demolitions and to get more money for affordable housing both, we want to make it apply to as much as possible. So to my mind, yes, you would charge $50,000 for a duplex being demolished. That destroys two affordable homes.
So then I hear an amendment to clarify that unit means individual dwelling unit, right?
That was the way I was reading it in the code, but you're saying the exhibit says something different.
Well, it may only need to be clarified in the administrative rules, as it does say unit in the code, right?
Right. I think the paragraph that describes residential structure suggests that maybe you would apply it per unit that's demolished. I think we might just modify the paragraph 6.08.030, demolition tax, which only refers to a single residential permit.
So we'd be saying there's lots of houses in my neighborhood that look like on the outside a single family residence, but they have two entrances. So there's under one roof, there's two homes, which are generally in the rental market a little more affordable and under one roof. So that unit you're suggesting for purpose of the demolition tax, we would charge $50,000 for that demolition?
The way staff understands the exhibit as written, no. There would only be $25,000 charged. If we want to clarify it to say that it should be charged against each residential unit, regardless that there's only one demolition permit applied for and pulled.
But there's a conflict between 020E, where it says it's a structure is a dwelling unit, and 030, which says a permit for the whole structure. So it's really a policy call as to whether...
It's a policy call for us.
Right.
So is there a motion to clarify our policy call?
And that motion would be to say at the end of that first sentence in 030, it would say the sum of $25,000 per unit.
Add the words per unit at that point. That would do it.
Yeah, so that's the motion.
So Commissioner Fritz moves that we add the words two per unit at that point to make that clear. Is there a second?
Per dwelling unit?
Yeah.
Per dwelling unit.
Per dwelling unit,
yes.
Right. Thank you.
Second.
Second. Further discussion of that? Okay. Roll call. I'm sorry.
Julian, you said it's fairly uncommon that we would encounter these.
It's fairly uncommon now.
Right now. Yeah. So the universe is pretty finite then of multi-unit dwellings on, in residential zones.
Yeah, among other things, because the corner duplex requirements or allowance has only been in the code for about 20, 25 years. So not that many old buildings that are in that situation.
And there aren't any multifamily, I mean, truly multifamily apartments in single-family zones. Is that correct?
No.
There are.
There's some.
Non-conforming.
Are we fixing that in the comp plan, or?
In some cases, yes. But in other cases where it's just an island surrounded by single family, no, we're leaving that.
But if the building's obviously there and habitable, then I would say
we would certainly want to stop it from being demolished,
right?
Yeah.
If it hasn't been declared derelict, we want it to stick around.
Yeah.
Okay.
So just me. I'm not going to support this, but we do have some examples at the Water Bureau where people technically live in duplexes that have been condemned because they can't maintain them, get liens against them, and then they're demolished for a new home, and people are not getting the return on the investment of their homes that I think they ought to, but that's because there's some speculative developers out there taking advantage of people that are in homes, particularly and there's some duplexes, but I'm going to vote no because, A, I'm not sure it's the right policy, and, B, I'm not sure I fully understand it, and, C, I still want to get to some other votes before
I do too.
Before I pass out from hunger and fatigue. So let's just take this to a vote.
All right. Let's do. Please. Roll call.
Novit.
I believe that here the pro-density and pro-affordability position is aye.
Agreed. Aye.
Fish?
No.
Balsman?
Aye.
All right. Okay. Thank you all very much.
This good work. Will Thank you, staff.
Come back to second reading next week. Okay. Now, we do have a little bit of important work left to do, and I know we're tired here, so let's try to move.
Mayor, I know a lot of people have been waiting for 1219. Should we call that first?
Yes, they have. So let's please move to 1219.
Second reading? Vote.
Yes. Roll call vote on 1219.
1219?
Yep.
Add code removing barriers to employment to establish procedures for use of criminal history information by employers within the city. Novit.
Roll call, please.
About 10 years ago, I was working for a cute little public policy nonprofit called Citizens for Oregon's Future. And at one point, taking off in the state's quality education model, we were tasked by our board to develop what we called a quality civilization model, figuring out, you know, what should the state do to have a quality civilization in all respects. And one of the things that I was looking at was the criminal justice system. And one of the things I heard from experts at that time is that one of the most important things you can do to reduce recidivism is to get people who are coming out of custody into jobs. And I think I'm recalling correctly when I say that there was a professor in Cincinnati who told me that up to a certain amount of time, maybe it was 1 month or even more, every day that somebody has a job after being released from prison, the risk of recidivism goes down by an entire percentage point. So if you've got a job for 30 days, you're 30% less likely to recidivate. The New York Times reported in February that the share of American men with criminal records, particularly black men, grew rapidly in recent decades as the government pursued more aggressive law enforcement strategies, especially against drug crimes. The reluctance of employers to hire people with criminal records is taking a toll on the broader economy. It is preventing millions of American men from becoming, in that old phrase, productive members of society. The bitter irony, of course, is that, as I just said, ex-offenders who find jobs are much less likely to reoffend. So discrimination against people with criminal histories actually results in more criminal behavior. This ordinance would provide that with limited exceptions, prospective employers may not conduct a criminal history background check on an applicant until after making a conditional offer of employment. If their background check shows an offense that the employer has a good faith belief is a disqualifier for that particular job, the employer may withdraw the offer. The point of this rule is to ensure that people with criminal records have a fair chance to get through the interview process. It's very easy for employers to simply screen out applicants based on background checks without giving much thought to whether the criminal record is actually relevant to the job. If there's no background check until the interview process is concluded, an employer is likely to evaluate the applicant on his or her true merits, make a deliberate rather than knee-jerk judgment as to whether the applicant's criminal history is truly relevant. I am extremely proud that this council is going to pass this ordinance. It will be one of the two proudest days of my service on the council, the first being when we pass the paid sick leave ordinance
a couple of years ago. We are going to have to pay attention to the administrative rules. I think that some employers have concerns about what good faith belief means, so we will address that. But I think that this is a tremendous day for Portland. This is an important civil rights ordinance. Aye.
One of the most compelling pieces of testimony that I heard is that black men with no criminal record are less likely to get an interview than white men with a criminal record. So that is proof that that there are many different biases within our system and that we need to do more to address all of them. This is definitely a step in the right direction. I did meet with the Portland Business Alliance and had a good discussion on this issue. To clarify, the state's law simply prevents employers from requiring applicants to disclose prior to an initial interview. The first question in the interview, according to the state law, can be, "What? Tell us about your criminal background, or do you have a criminal background?" This ordinance is a huge step forward. It requires that employers must be committed to hiring individuals before considering the criminal record. And we've had experience of this within the city since we banned the box within the city for our own hiring. The city's law still allows employers to consider applicants' criminal history at any point during the hiring process if the position involves direct access to children, elderly people, people with disabilities, people with mental illnesses, or individuals with alcohol and drug dependence disorders, and if there is a need for consideration according to the duties of the job. So for somebody who's going to be going into other people's homes or other personal spaces, then absolutely it can be considered ahead of time. It's a very straightforward policy. It's very clean. It's clear. I very much appreciate the good work of Judy Prosper, Rachel Wiggins, and Christina Nieves in my home. Like Commissioner Novick, I'm very proud to vote aye.
Well, first, I want to acknowledge the goal that brings us to this moment. And it's a goal that is shared by everyone, regardless of where they come out on the underlying ordinance. And the goal is, in my mind, threefold. One is to remove barriers. And this council has shown a hearty commitment to identifying and removing barriers in our community. The second is to promote access to employment and making sure that everyone has a chance to pursue their dream and become self-sufficient. And the third is to address the pervasive racial disparities which continue to hold too many people back in our community. These are core values that I share and that led me to practice civil rights law for about 20 years and now guide my work as a city commissioner. Now, we've had a spirited debate about how to translate those goals into action. And I join with my colleagues in stating how proud I am that the city of Portland has already taken affirmative action to ban the box. And I support many of the compromises that have been worked out through the committee process. In particular, the exemption for very small businesses, the effective date of next summer, which will give us a chance to put this into place and do effective outreach and education. A commitment that annually we'll look at the data and do some oversight to see if there are changes and tweaks that are needed. And the decision that we will contract with Boley to do enforcement rather than creating a separate enforcement bureau within the legal department, which I strongly I support this approach. I have some concerns about the ordinance, and I think it's worth acknowledging them because ultimately we want this to be successful. We're acting ahead of state law, ahead of having a chance to see whether state law actually works. And we are, in some instances, creating a two-tiered system. I believe, based on the work I used to do representing plaintiffs in employment cases, that there will be a subtle encouragement through this approach for people to do the kind of profiling that we abhor. And the profiling that an employer who is savvy and unprincipled will do is use information that is apparent but not vetted to make a judgment about an applicant pool and exclude that person from getting to the point of a conditional offer, which is where the enforcement mechanism kicks in. And as I indicated last time, the area I'm most concerned about, because it's the area I think where you'll see the greatest abuse, is gaps in people's employment history on a resume. And it would be a shame if all this well-intentioned effort led to employers screening people in ways to prevent them from getting the conditional offer and thereby undermining what we're trying to do. And the third thing that gives me some pause is that we have some employers in our community who have actually not just talked about this but done something. And Dave's Killer Bread is an example of a company that has made a commitment to hire people who have records, and they brought them in and given them opportunities, meaningful careers within the company. And they have found upstream a more open and candid conversation helpful. But again, they are a unique employer in that they have an explicit set of values around their hiring, and I'm not sure we can extrapolate from them to every other employer. These are real concerns, because if we're going to adopt this, we need to make sure it actually has an impact. And I guess reasonable people could reach different conclusions. And I think we should track the data carefully, Mayor, to make sure that this actually has the intended benefit. But today I proudly stand with the Urban League and the coalition they have assembled, and mostly with the men and women who seek a second chance in our community in supporting this ordinance. And I want to explicitly single out one person, and that's Emmanuel Price. He has impressed me with the passion of his advocacy, and he has inspired me with his life story. And in his name, I vote aye.
Well, I am very persuaded by the eloquence of my colleagues that have spoken and voted ahead of me. I do, you know, echo some of the concerns Commissioner Fish just echoed about this ordinance. The state did pass something, but I note that they chose not to preempt local governments. So this is the opportunity before us, and I think we should take it, because the issue of hiring of people with records is so enormous and so consequential to our society and dealing with issues of race and inequality that we should be grasping at anything that will hopefully change the course of the present statistics and situations around the hiring of in particular, African-American males. So we need to act, and I do believe that there has to be good, we have to recognize employers that make good faith efforts, and if they make a determination that somebody's record at the point of a conditional offer does warrant not offering that job, whether it's issues around having access to keys to people's apartments or all the other things we've written into the ordinance and will flesh out in the rulemaking, then we need to respect that and respect the employer's ability to make a good faith effort and honor that. And that's been done in the San Francisco ordinance, I would note. So all in all, I want to thank Mayor Hills for his persistence in this issue, and I look forward to hopefully making a difference. Aye.
Well, I want to thank you all. I think anyone listening to this would understand that this is a city council that has a commitment to equity and opportunity in our city, and I'm proud of being a member of this council today, as I am so many other days. But this is an important day. This is a big deal. And I do want to thank especially Rachel Wiggins and Judy Prosper and Josh Alpert on my staff who have, and the city attorney's office, who have worked so hard on this. This is a case where community advocates, the AFL-CIO, the Urban League, others have really come to their city council with a cry for justice, and we've responded. And I'm proud of us for being that place where, one, we are willing to respond, but two, the community can come forward that way and with clarity of purpose and clarity of goal tell us what the right thing is to do. So thank you to those who have been advocating for this issue. I think a lot of us have had enough experience with this issue, as you just did, Commissioner Fish, to have personal contact with people who we'd love to see society not label as ex-cons. People who've paid their debt in the criminal justice system shouldn't have to carry that label. And we hope that the effect of this change in how people think about the content of people's characters as they're applying for jobs will change that nomenclature and change people's hearts. And that's, I think, the best thing that could come from this ordinance. So in addition to the others that have been mentioned, for Stefan and for Robert and for Meg, aye. Thank you all.